of Let's Talk Shakespeare, a podcast brought to you from Stratford-upon-Avon by the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. I'm Jennifer Reid, and today I'm asking, how much was William Shakespeare worth? Now, this is quite an interesting one, and most of the information and evidence we have about Shakespeare's life comes from legal documents and deeds that have survived. Now, people argue that they don't tell as much about Shakespeare the man and his motivations, but actually they do, and they can tell us a lot more than they first suggest. But there are various difficulties with comparing monetary values over time, and the first person I have speaking today is Liz Dollymore, who is the learning manager at the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, to summarise some of these problems and kick off the conversation.
It's terribly difficult to make comparisons between Tudor monetary value and our own currency. And you know, if you work it out for one thing or another thing, it seems not to carry through proportionately to other things. So, for instance, the schoolmaster got something like £25 a year, which seems like impossibly nothing, but he probably would have got food and housing on top of that. But other things, if you multiply them by, say, 1,000, saying a modern school teacher gets about 25,000 a year, maybe 23 is starting wage, something like that. It doesn't carry through to other things. If you make the same sum for the value of apples or something, you don't get a logical answer. So it's really difficult to say how much he was worth in kind of today's terms. He was certainly wealthy. After all, he purchased New Place, which was an expensive property. He also made expensive purchases of land within and around Stratford-upon-Avon. But those things made him more money because he bought the land, and along with the land came a right to a percentage of the agricultural profits from that land. So he invested and made money. I mean, he wasn't sort of so wealthy it was kind of impossible, if you know what I mean. He wasn't like a modern day celebrity or a footballer who just has, you know, an impossibly enormous bank balance, but he was certainly better off than your average Joe by quite a way. I think that the majority of the money he made was really from the land investments. I think the working in the theatre gave him enough to start that process, and then the rest of that was probably savvy land investments in Stratford, of which he made 2-3 in his lifetime.
Liz mentioned there how Shakespeare made his money and what he did with it. And when I first started putting this podcast episode together, I'd planned on splitting it up into how Shakespeare made his money, what he did with it, and where it went when he died. But I very quickly realised that these things are all tangled up with each other. So you'll find that we jump about a bit on the timeline in this episode. So first of all, let's think about how he made that initial money to make his investments. And let's start at the very beginning with his family and their money. Most of us have heard the story of John Shakespeare and his rise and fall. And here is Bob Bierman to tell us a bit about the status of Shakespeare's family when he was growing up.
Right, well, my view of that is that John Shakespeare came from a rural background, but he wanted to advance the family's status and set himself up in Stratford as well as a businessman, dealing in glove making and wool dealing. And in this he was quite successful, and he rose fairly quickly in the civic ranks, you know, filling a number of important posts and then culminating in being a bailiff, or mayor as we call it. But then in the late 1570s, there's evidence of him falling on hard times. He mortgaged and then sold his real estate. We know he has pursued the debt for various by various people, and thereafter he seems to have his business seems to have collapsed. I think my own view about this is that there was a sort of move against wool dealing in the late 1570s. People were agitating against people who were dealing in virtually illegal wool dealing, and that he overreached himself and didn't have the credit to tide him over a difficult period. And there's evidence after that that his you know, business dealings virtually disappeared from the records. I mean, there could be other reasons. He could have been ill, of course, but we don't actually know. He lived into his 70s, so he was obviously of quite a robust constitution, I think. But my feeling is that he ran into difficulties, financial difficulties, in the late 1570s, just at the time when Shakespeare, you know, William Shakespeare, was coming to maturity, and that this had an effect on the sort of thing that Shakespeare could then get involved in. He for one reason or another, we're not quite sure, but he didn't go to university, so this ruled out any career in the law or in the church. He wasn't apprenticed for any trade, and therefore his options were rather limited, and he just seems to have taken off to London, you know, and made his living by his pen. Well, first of all, by acting, I suspect. I mean, in fact, he always got more money from being involved in the, you know, theatrical company as an actor or as a sharer than he did in actually writing plays. But he obviously managed to get himself attached to one of the playing companies and built up his career from there. But I don't think... I mean, I know that there are other people who think differently, but I don't think his father was helping him. I think his father was in difficult circumstances, and only when Shakespeare began to earn some money is there any evidence of the family fortunes reviving.
Okay, so he didn't have family money as such. Now, Bob mentioned there that he wasn't apprenticed and he didn't go to university, and this would have been further hampered by his marriage at the young age, at 17 or 18, to a much older Anne. And this is covered in more detail in episode 2 of this series, so if you want to find out more about that one, go check it out. So we have young Shakespeare, not particularly wealthy, newly married, very quickly having 3 children, Susanna, followed by the twins Hamnet and Judith, putting further strain on the family's finances. So he had to make some money somehow, and we do know that at some point after the birth of his children, he packed his bags and went off to London and made his fortune there. But how much did he make, and how did he make it? Bob again to tell us a bit about this.
Well, this is a bit of a grey area, because there's no... The actual financial accounts of the Chamberlain's men, or the King's men, as they became under James, there are no surviving accounts of their income. William Shakespeare became a sharer in sort of 1593-1594, which meant that after they paid all the expenses, the sharers in the company would get a share of the profits. I mean, nobody, but as we don't know the number of performances they put on, the size of the auditorium, or how much people were paying, we can't be sure what that was, but people have said he could have been earning about, you know, £60-70 a year at that stage. When they built the Globe Theatre, and he became a housekeeper as well, he became not only a sharer in the profits of the performances, but also a sharer in the overall profits of the company. They reckon his income could have peaked at about £200 a year, which would have been a lot of money then, but because there are no surviving accounts, it is, you know, a bit of guesswork in a way. And then, of course, this would be £200 in a good year. There's no record, for quite long periods, especially after 1606, the theatres were closed during outbreaks of plague. So that would have had an adverse effect on his income. So although, you know, you might say in a good year, he could have earned £200. In a bad year, it could have been much less, and we don't know how much less. But it is, in a sense, it's a bit of guesswork, because we don't have the accounts.
So what can we use as evidence?
Well, you can... Well, these figures have been worked out by Andrew Gower, having looking at what accounts for other companies do survive, and the size of auditoria that we do know of, and how much other people pay on average. So you can get a rough figure. But whatever it is, it's going to be quite considerably more than he was getting in any other way. I mean, what tended to happen was he obviously earned more money than he needed for his immediate purposes. So he was able to invest. He was able to invest surplus income, or he could borrow on credit and then repay, you know, rather like we do a mortgage today. He could repay over a period of years out of his profits. So he invested some of his what we call surplus income. Well, first of all, in buying new plays, of course, which probably cost him £120 or so. He then invested in a share in 107 acres of land that cost him £320. That was in 1602. And then in 1605, he spent raised £440 to buy a share in the Tithes. So that's getting on for £900 that he was investing to provide himself an income. And of course, at the same time, he was having to buy himself into the King's order, into the Chamberlain's men, and then to become a housekeeper. That would have cost him another £150, say. So he was obviously able to raise these sums of money on because his credit was good. You know, rather unlike his father, who obviously fell foul of everything because he didn't have the credit.
So Bob there gave a brief overview of Shakespeare's investments, and we'll come back to those repeatedly over the rest of this episode. So here we have Shakespeare making money out of the theatre, not just being an actor, but being a sharer in the company too. And that seems to have been where the money was. So was this a standard thing for actors to do? Did any other actors become as wealthy as Shakespeare? Michael Dobson is the director of the Shakespeare Institute, and let's see what he said about this.
No, I mean, only two others. I mean, Johnson gets a steady court income because he more or less becomes poet laureate before the job is officially invented, but he still dies pretty hard up, so that, you know, he has to be buried standing up in Westminster Abbey because, you know, you buy the burial plot in terms of surface area, so if you don't mind standing up, you can pay less money in it. But no, it's very unusual. Thomas Middleton, who worked as City Chronologer and was very prolific and quite canny, unfortunately ran foul of the censor at the end of his career, and again seems to have died more or less in hiding without being able to leave much. I don't think there's anybody else who's quite as good a businessman as well as being a writer as Shakespeare at the time.
Now, like I said earlier, how Shakespeare made his money and what he spent it on are inextricably linked. He made some smart investments, and he lived in a society where money was invested, borrowed, and moved around a great deal. Tara Hamling is a lecturer in early modern history at the University of Birmingham, and she can explain this a bit more.
Okay, so the question of how much money they had is interesting. We don't know very much at all about John Shakespeare or William Shakespeare, so we can't be very specific. But taking people of their kind of status, so middling to upper middling status, we've got documents and accounts for other individuals of that status that tells us that they're constantly walking a very difficult balancing act between debt and capital. What they're doing, basically, every time money comes in, it's going out again. Because people at this sort of level, they're involved, obviously, in business, they're involved in trade, they're having to buy goods in and support their particular trade or industry. So what they tend to do is to be loaning money out left, right and centre. So any money that they have, they put out into action in the world. And that's a form of capital that is social as well as economic, because it's in everyone's interests to keep these business networks going. So if you're working closely with someone, you need them to stay afloat as well as yourself. So it's very, very complex sort of situation of constantly keeping cash flow moving. So it's unlikely that there would have been a big stash of money in a safe in a new place. It's more likely that you would put your money to use in some particular venture or invest in somebody. And that meant that ready money was actually relatively rare. And in fact, another bequest in Shakespeare's will is of gold coins to his godson. And gold coins is a very specific kind of bequest. It's not just cash that you can use that you might spend frivolously. So it's a bit like a godparent leaving premium bonds to a godchild, sort of expectation that that's a long-term investment rather than just something that you spend as ready cash. So no, not a huge amount of money around. Money is put to use.
So going back to what Shakespeare spent and bought, most of my clips today mention at least one of his investments. And my next clip is from Professor Stanley Wells, and he can summarise all these purchases nicely for us.
The theatre was quite a profitable profession in Shakespeare's time. It was very popular. The theatres held a lot of people, anything up to 3,000 people. Sometimes the theatres had to close and actors would be on hard times in periods of plague, when, quite rightly, the government felt that there shouldn't be large assemblies of people for fear of spreading the plague even more. But nevertheless, some of the actors, including Shakespeare himself, became quite wealthy. Hemings and Cundall, for example, had biggish houses in London, and Burbage was well off. How it's very difficult, of course, to convey wealth in terms of modern financial equivalents. But Shakespeare himself became wealthy, partly, certainly, through his profession, because theatre made money. He, as I've said, he became wealthy enough to buy the second biggest house in Stratford when he was only 33. He bought land in Stratford a couple of years later. A few years after that, in the early 17th century, he paid a considerable sum of money for the Stratford tithes. That is an investment in the money that was given, that people had to pay the church, and he had a 10% interest in that. So he certainly made money. Whether he made it all through the theatre, we don't know. There is this new theory that his father became a rich man through wool dealing, which might mean that his father helped him, perhaps, to buy a new place, or to buy his shares in the theatre company, because that would have cost money too. But when he died, yes, he left a good deal of property. It's very difficult to give a modern equivalent for it. He certainly would be what you would call a millionaire nowadays. I mean, nowadays, if you own a house which has 20 or 30 rooms, you'd certainly be a millionaire, wouldn't you? He left money to his daughters. He left plate, that is to say gold and silver, which went eventually to his granddaughter. So he died a relatively wealthy man, owner of the second biggest house in Stratford, bequeathing silver plate, bequeathing money, bequeathing land to his daughter Susanna, and bequeathing property. His granddaughter, Elizabeth, became quite a grand lady. She became Lady Elizabeth Bernard. She married somebody who was a knight, and she lived in an even greater house in Abingdon, where her husband lived. I sometimes think it's quite interesting to chart the Shakespeare family residences. You can go from Mary Arden's farm, or Mary Arden's house, where his mother was born, which is at Wilmcote, just outside Stratford, relatively small farmhouse, then come into Stratford, come into Shakespeare's birthplace, quite a substantial house. Have a look at that now. It has three gables. It's a bigger house than most people live in nowadays. Then he buys the big house, New Place, when he's only 33, a house with five gables, a house with a courtyard, with a big garden, orchards, probably with livestock around. And then from New Place, you can go to the house that his granddaughter bought, or that his granddaughter married into, Abingdon Hall. It's a succession illustrating the upward mobility, the upward social mobility of the period, where people could go from, almost rags to definitely riches. And the Shakespeare family followed that trajectory till in the early 17th century you get Shakespeare's granddaughter being Lady Elizabeth Bernard.
What becomes clear is that Shakespeare is a man who was interested in wealth and investment and the status that was attached to this. It's easy to speculate how his father's fall from grace as a child affected Shakespeare's drive for wealth and recognition. And in 1596, the Shakespeare family was granted a coat of arms. And it's not clear whether or not it was William that applied for this, as it was awarded to his father, John. But here is a clip from Bob Meerman, again to think about what this investment meant and the status that came with it.
Yeah, well, the coat of arms is the first sign, I suppose, we have of the Shakespeare family's renaissance, if you like. We can't be sure, of course, that it was William Shakespeare who was behind it, because the grant was actually made to his father, John, because he was still head of the family. But because Shakespeare was sort of in London, and because his earnings in the theatre were now beginning to make some sort of an impression, I think it's almost certain that he would have been behind it. Whether the actual motives are slightly more complicated. I mean, if William Shakespeare was involved, was he trying to make amends for the extra complications he'd introduced in the family by marrying so young and not going in for a standard apprenticeship? Or was he you know, trying to comfort his father in some way, who'd fallen on hard times and wanted to re-establish, show the family being re-established. We just don't know, but I don't think Shakespeare was trying to found a dynasty, because his son Hamlet had just died, so he had no son to inherit this title or this sort of status of gentry. I mean, he might, I suppose, have, you know, Anne was already in her 40s by then. He might have, he could have been imagining that Anne might die, he might be married and have sons and so on, but I mean, that's a bit too calculating, isn't it? So I don't think he was trying to set up his family as a gentry family. I think he may have been just doing it because he wanted to, you know, bring some comfort to his father.
And how much would that cost?
We don't know for certain, in Shakespeare's case, but people who were being granted coats of arms at that time were paying about £20. So it wasn't a small sum of money. I mean, £20 was the annual salary of the schoolmaster at that time, so you know, you had to have quite a bit of money up your sleeve to actually do that. And of course, a few years after that, they approached the College of Arms again, you know, to quarter the arms of the Ardens as well. So they were obviously thinking they had another £20 or so to hand.
So what we've got here is an adult Shakespeare as a fairly wealthy man, probably considerably wealthier than most of his peers in the theatre and in London. He's a landowner and a property owner, and now he's got a coat of arms, he's a gentleman. But what about back home in Stratford-upon-Avon? How did he compare to his peers here? Back to Bob again.
Well, this is what got me interested in the whole thing in the first place, because people were making this rather, they had a broad theory that Shakespeare was a very, very successful actor and playwright, and therefore he must have made loads and loads of money and died a wealthy man. And, you know, but nobody actually produced any evidence of that. And what appeared to me was totally unconvincing. So what I began by doing was to look at his will, which is the only document we have for estimating the amount of money he might have had to hand, or at least that could be raised on his estates, and compared it with wills of other Stratford gentry. I mean, there's obviously, you can't be too categorical about that, but the amount of, the number of pecuniary bequests in a will is at least an indication of something. So I looked at the money bequests in Shakespeare's will, and they come to a comparatively modest 355. £300 of which was actually settled on his younger daughter in two instalments, £150 each, £150 straight away, and then £150 in 3 years. But only another £55 in money bequests was made to other people. And I thought, well, actually, that's not evidence of a lot of money to hand anyway. And then when I looked at wills of other Stratford town gentry, you know, people like John Coombe, who left money bequests, £1,600. His brother Thomas Coombe, £1,215. Anthony Nash, who was well connected, who has lots of evidence of connections with Shakespeare, £1,170. Richard Woodward, £660. And even William Walford, who was a woolen draper, £610. So in terms of money bequests in the will, Shakespeare ended up in sixth place. So then I looked at where those town gentry stood in the wider circle, and the Coombes, actually, in terms of paying tax, the Coombes were top, paying £4 on value on their land, and the Nashes with £2. But the real gentry, people like the Lucys of Charlcote, were paying £30. So Shakespeare hadn't even got into the ranks of the minor gentry, let alone the real gentry. And so I began to look at other things, like, you know, what happened to his daughters. Quite a lot of these town gentry were either marrying people of the same social status or made sure their daughters married well. But when you think of what happens to Shakespeare's daughters, one of them married a second son of a doctor, and the other one the third son of a mercer. neither of whom apparently settled any money or brought any money into the family when they married. John Hall, who married Susanna, he was obviously quite a successful doctor, but he went on working as a doctor. He didn't become a man of independent means. And Judith, who married Thomas Quiney, well, Quiney was a bit of a ne'er-do-well and sort of died in poverty. So you think, well, you know, this is not the typical fate of daughters who are married into the gentry. So I then thought, well, you know, perhaps he wasn't that wealthy when he died. I mean, obviously he was of considerable means. To have left £300 to one of his daughters was an indication that he thought his estate at least could bear that sort of bequest. But it didn't compare with even the sort of bequest that you find in other minor town gentry. I mean, these people, John Coombe, he was the wealthiest probably in Stratford, but he wasn't one of the local, squirearchy or anything. So I just think, well, perhaps William Shakespeare wasn't or didn't die as wealthy a man as some people would like to think.
What about in comparison to other people in theatre?
Well, the picture is rather different because there is a good edition of all wills that were made by people connected with the London theatres. Susan Brock helped Ernst Hollingman to edit. And there you can see that if you look at the wills of sharers in the King's Men, who were the most exact comparable, you find that although some of them did have some property in London and they made reasonably generous bequests, they weren't as wealthy in that sense as Shakespeare. So he may have done a bit better than they did, perhaps because he was writing plays as well as being a sharer, or perhaps he was just more sort of sensible in his in the way he handled his money. And these people, of course, the other difference, I suppose, is that Shakespeare was actually maintaining two households. I mean, he had his family living in Stratford, he was providing for, but also a man must have been paying for his own expenses in London, whereas his fellow sharers seemed to be based in London and that was it. But certainly there is evidence of him, as far as ordinary fellow sharers were concerned, of being slightly more successful financially than they were. That's not counting the theatre owners, by the way, the theatre managers, who certainly did die very wealthy men. Mm-hmm. These are his fellow sharers.
So that takes us to the end of Shakespeare's life and leads nicely on to my final clip for today's episode. Let's have a wee look at how he spent his money at the end of his life and what this can tell us about how he was still earning.
But the interesting thing about all that is that once he bought his share in the Tithes in 1605, there are no further large-scale purchases, which is a bit odd if you think about it, because you'd think he'd been able to keep raising these quite large sums of money to invest. After that, there's definitely a slackening off, and this may be, people have suggested that his income was dropping because of play closures. Also, of course, his output as a writer tended to slacken off in these years, and quite a few of the plays also were written in collaboration with other people as well, which would have affected his author's fee. You could argue that he wasn't buying any more property, but he could have been sort of lending money to people. He could have been a merchant adventurer or something, investing in one of the trading companies. But of this, it's not impossible. And some people, I think, have suggested it. But of this, there's no evidence. The only evidence we have for his financial situation at the end of his life is his will. And if you look at his will, and we can go through that if you like at some point, there's no evidence of a person with very large sums of money to hand, or large sums of money owing to him because he'd lent money out, or any investments in trading companies and so on. So I think that's probably not true either. So I think his income was going down. But having said that, I mean, one ought to... I have made a calculation that even that these investments wouldn't have earned him much more than, say, £70. We know we can work out actually what he's getting in the way of rent from the properties he bought. So £70, when you compare it with, you know, £200 from the theatre, it wasn't a major source of income. Or it wouldn't be, it wasn't his major source of income while he was still in the theatre. But the big question mark is, did he surrender his theatre shares? There's lots of evidence, well, I think there's good evidence in 1613 that for some reason he sold his shares, which would have meant that there'd been quite a big fall in his income at the end of his life.
What's that evidence?
Well, just that if he sold his shares, he wouldn't have his theatre income.
Right.
Oh, what you mean, what's the evidence? Well, the reason we think that the shares were sold is because they don't feature in his will. He didn't leave them specifically to anybody. I mean, it's possible that it was sort of included in some sort of catch-all phrase at the end of his will, saying, I leave all the rest of my estate to my daughter, but there's no evidence of her owning them either. So the implication is that he did sell them, in which case he was giving up a large proportion of his income. I mean, there again, you know, again, he might have been ill. He might have been worn out, actually, writing plays over that period of years, or even acting. He might have been ill, we just don't know, but there's obviously evidence of a withdrawal, if you like, from the main focus of the theatre. I mean, there is this odd thing about the purchase of the Blackfriars Gatehouse in 1613, but there, interestingly, that was only going to cost him £140, but he was actually £60 short of that sum of money when the deed went through, and he had to mortgage the property back for over 6 months until he could come up with the rest with the rest of the money, which sort of suggests that he wasn't quite so flush at that point. And there are various sort of possibilities as to why he purchased that property, I suppose. It was bought with three other trustees, which is rather curious, one of whom was John Hemmings, who is a fellow sharer in the King's Men. And it's rather, to me, it suggests that actually he was going to stay on. He secured himself like a bolt hole in London where he could work or retain his links with the theatre, because, you know, Blackfriars Theatre was right next door to Blackfriars Gatehouse, and that somehow he could go on perhaps writing plays for the company but not actually being a full sharer. But that's, we just don't know really quite why he bought the Blackfriars Gatehouse. He installed a chap called John Robinson in it, who remained there after his after his death, and in a sort of protected tenancy, because when the trusteeship passed to a new group of trustees, they said this was allowing for the continuing tenancy of John Robinson as arranged by Shakespeare. So there's obviously something going on there we're not quite sure about.
Well, that's a perfect end to this episode, because next week's episode will be asking, how did Shakespeare die? And we'll be covering the subject of his will in a lot more detail, so do tune in next week to hear that. You probably noticed that in this episode I had a lot of clips from Bob Bierman, and that's because Bob has a book out next year. And that book is called Shakespeare's Money, How Much Did He Make and What Did This Mean? And that'll be out in spring next year, March I think it is, and it's available to pre-order on Amazon as we speak. So thanks for joining me today, and thank you to Stanley, Bob, Tara and Liz for speaking to me. And of course, a special thanks to the Friends of the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust who make this podcast possible. You can check out the accompanying show notes for this episode over on our blog, findingshakespeare.co.uk. And we are on Twitter at ShakespeareBT, or tweet us using the hashtag TalkShakespeare. Do join us next week for episode 9, and we will be asking, how did Shakespeare die?